This broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is recorded, so we're not taking any new phone calls.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The news is full of stories about athletes who use banned substances to enhance their performance. Schools across the country debate the use of drugs to improve cognitive abilities, and scientists are developing new techniques to prevent aging, assist reproduction, and manipulate genes. A new book titled The Price of Perfection examines the ethical, scientific, and public policy quandaries of biomedical enhancement. Author Maxwell Melman is a professor of bioethics and law at Case Western University. He joins us to talk about the pitfalls as well as the benefits of biomedical enhancement. And we do invite your calls, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning to you, sir. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. My pleasure.
I must say, biomedical enhancement would seem to involve a great many aspects of both physical outward and physical inward enhancements. Describe what you mean.
Well, it's a very broad range of technologies. I mean, it includes cosmetic surgery, for example. People in China, for example, do something called leg lengthening surgery because being tall in China is a particular asset. And so they break their legs, pull the bones apart, and then fix them just far enough apart so they can re-knit, giving them another inch or so. And then they do it again and again until they gain length. It includes all of the drugs that people are taking who have normal sort of cognitive abilities but are taking to, say, do better on a law school exam, for example, or to do better on, for example, a game show, something like that. It includes the enormous amount of research that the military is doing to give war fighters, as they're now called, advantages on the battlefield. It includes many of the things that athletes take, illegal things that athletes take to try to win a medal.
What is fascinating to me is that yesterday in the New York Times, in their Science Times section, there was a piece on the front page, and the headline was, "Life can be extended for mice and worms. Now researchers may learn whether the same can be done for our favorite species, meaning us." And on the left-hand side, you see an aged hand. On the right-hand side, a rather youthful hand. Is that also part of what you're talking about in biomedical enhancement, that is extending youthfulness?
Yes. Well, that's a very controversial subject, because it all depends on whether you think of aging as an illness or a pathological progression, or if you think of it as a normal or even desirable part of life. Because if we think of it as the result of disease, then something to extend life would be viewed as a treatment, not as an enhancement.
Are there some physician scientists out there who do regard aging as a disease?
Well, as a disease, or as the culmination or the cumulative effect of a variety of disease processes. Yes, that's a common view. Others view aging as a normal part of the human life, and therefore an effort to try to extend a lifespan or retard aging to them would be viewed as an enhancement.
Now, if you're talking about something like plastic surgery, which many women and men may use simply to attempt to halt or slow the aging of the face, for example, there's not too much controversy about that, is there?
Not about adults. There's controversy about teenagers using those sorts of things. And an interesting question is, should that be illegal in beauty pageants? Should contestants be able to use cosmetic surgery to look, you know, to look better in beauty pageants? And interestingly, beauty pageants do not prohibit cosmetic surgery, and in fact, some of them have actually had beauty cosmetic surgery consultants on their staffs to help advise the contestants on how to do that.
So what you're saying is that that effort to look beautiful is happening at earlier and earlier ages.
Oh, yes. I mean, there's a story about how parents in Southern California give their daughters breast augmentation as a high school graduation present. And we know the number of teenagers who go for nose jobs and other kinds of cosmetic procedures. And also, you know, not just cosmetic surgery, but also the use of cognitive enhancement drugs by students. I was shocked when my research assistant told me when I was researching this book. Well, we all use, I think the drug of choice now is something called Adderall, which is an amphetamine. We all use that when we take our exams, and I had no idea, to be honest with you.
And that is to speed up the thinking process, make it sharper.
Focus, more alertness.
Well, tell me about some of the objections that have been raised at using these kinds of biomedical enhancements to either look or feel better.
Well, the first objection is that they're dangerous, that they're hazardous to health, and some of them certainly are. Well, for example, steroids are very dangerous for youngsters because it interferes with the growth of their bones, the fusing of their bone plates, and so they shouldn't use steroids, certainly.
Do they know that as they begin taking them?
Probably not. In fact, it's very hard to get good information about the dangers of steroids. Unfortunately, although I haven't checked it recently, the government's own website, the National Institute for Drug Abuse's website, doesn't really have very accurate information on the dangers of steroids because it describes some of them, exaggerates some, and that sort of undercuts the persuasiveness of some of the other things that it talks about. So we have to be really careful that we have good scientific evidence behind our safety concerns. But there's no doubt. I mean, some cognitive enhancers like caffeine are relatively benign, but athletes have died from using Bengay. You know, people have died from drinking too much water, so nothing is completely safe. And that's
tell me how Bengay is used.
If you put on, this particular athlete had a susceptibility to the active ingredient in Bengay, and he used so much of it that he actually overdosed on it.
For an aching muscle or something of that sort. What about the President's Council on Bioethics? What does that say about these enhancements?
Well, even if they take the position, or at least a majority of them took the position, that even if these things were completely safe, there's still a problem with them. They don't think that achievements that are accomplished with the aid of enhancements are legitimate, are real. I think their major argument is that they're not earned. And we should only take credit for things that we actually earn. And you know, there's a lot of history in particularly the United States supporting that kind of approach. I mean, the American sort of dream is that if you work hard and you earn, you can earn anything. You know, you can have any measure of success. The problem with that approach is, of course, that many of the things that people accomplish, they haven't earned, or they haven't earned completely
because
they've inherited the genes that enable them to do them well, or they have good luck. And we certainly know that in sports, athletes who succeed do so surely in part because of the hard work they put in, but also in large part because of their good fortune.
Now, the Science Times article I referred to earlier discussed some genetic manipulation that could, in fact, lead to greater longevity.
Right. That's the sort of holy grail of biomedical enhancement, and that is that we will be able to actually manipulate or engineer the genes to give people greater abilities through their genetic profiles. And this is only in its very early stages at this point. There's some work that's being done to manipulate the genes of other animals. There's a project at NIH actually to figure out what genes contribute to dogs being able to run faster rather than slower. Right now, there's an increasing number of genetic tests being developed that test not just for disease susceptibilities, you know, like Alzheimer's or cancer, but also for non-disease traits like longevity or intelligence. And many of these are scientifically controversial because it's not clear they do what they say they do. But the idea is that not too long from now, parents might be able to test embryos that they produced by fertilizing eggs in the laboratory through in vitro fertilization, test embryos. They now test embryos to pick the ones that have the least diseases, genetic diseases, and only implant those in the mother's womb. But in the future, they could test for all kinds of traits and then only pick the most desirable embryos. And that's clearly not too far in the future.
The book we're talking about is titled The Price of Perfection, Individualism and Society in the Era of Biomedical Enhancement. Maxwell Melman is professor of bioethics and law at Case Western Reserve University. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can also reach us through Facebook and Twitter.
Good morning. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show on WAMU 88.5. The Prairie Home Companion is coming up next at 11.
Coming up Monday on the Kojo Namdi Show, public or private, local universities are the brain trust of our region, shaping life here almost as much as the federal government. We talk with the presidents of Georgetown University and the University of Maryland about their students, alumni, and neighbors. It's back to school all this week on the Kojo Namdi Show, noon till 2 Monday on WAMU 88.5.
A is for apple, B is for bluegrass, C is for country. Just $1.99 helps support bluegrass country, and you get to download the iPhone Apple app. Take Katie, Lee, and Ray with you. Listen to bluegrass country anywhere in the world. It's the Bluegrass Country iPhone app. Let us show you what it's all about. Visit bluegrasscountry.org for a download link.
This broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is recorded, so we're not taking any new phone calls.
And if you've just joined us, we're talking about biomedical enhancements, which certainly include physical enhancements to better your appearance, medications or supplements to improve your focus, enhance your mood or your creativity, as well as going to, as what Dr. Maxwell Melman calls, the holy grail of biomedical enhancement, and that is genetic modification. And we are taking your calls, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. The bottom line question, Dr. Melman, is all this fair?
Well, it would be unfair if only some people could get their hands on these technologies. if they were too expensive, for example, or if, as is the case with some athletes, you have to know who the designer chemist is and how to reach that person to get the samples of steroids that won't come up if you're tested, that won't be detected if you're tested. But on the other hand, you know, almost nothing about life is fair, and certainly very little about sports is fair. I mean, we compete, for example, internationally against countries that have, you know, minuscule resources to train and support their athletes, and that's not fair. And yet, we you know, sort of pretend it's a level playing field. And whenever new equipment is developed in sports, you know, whether it's the oversized tennis racket or the shaped ski, you know, the first athletes who get their hands on it have an advantage over the others. And the only unfairness would be if they could hang on to that equipment and nobody else could get their hands on it.
Here's an email from John Paul, who says, anyone who thinks that cosmetic enhancements are a joke should remember how many of us had metal strapped to our teeth to make us more attractive. Does that fall into that same category?
Well, it that's interesting because the dentists like to persuade you that this is not a matter of appearance. This is a matter of how your bite will work when you get older. You'll lose your teeth if they're not straight, and so on. And this is a tension in this field of biomedical enhancement because, for example, cosmetic surgeons often try to sell people their goods on the basis that you need cosmetic surgery to improve your mental health, not just to look better. So there's an effort to turn these things into medical treatments so that they don't come with the baggage that a medical enhancement has.
Here's an email from Paula in Tucson, who says, this is what I find so disappointing about Tiger Woods. He may have been the best in the world without his eye correction surgery, but we'll never know that.
Yeah, and of course he's not alone. Many baseball players, for example, have had eye surgery, and what that does is that it corrects your vision to better than 20/20. It corrects it, for example, to 20/5, which means that you can see things at 20 feet that a normal person could see only at 5 feet.
But it didn't, pardon me, didn't seem to help him against Y.E. Yang on Saturday.
Well, because there's so many other factors that contribute to success. And I've been told that in baseball now, because pitchers can pitch so fastballs so fast, that a successful batter has to have either naturally or artificially 20/5 vision, or they won't be able to see the ball to hit it.
Well, and that takes you to the question of whether employers might be able to force these kinds of enhancements on employees.
Yes. I mean, now, you know, we have employers testing their employees to make sure they're not taking drugs. And we can imagine in the not-too-distant future they'd be testing them to make sure they do. I mean, for example, there's already a drug called modafinil. Provigil is the brand name, which is an alertness drug. It's one of the things it's now approved for is for people who work swing shifts so that they can get a good night's sleep and work and be alert at their job.
What
the next
are the
day.
Side effects?
Modafinil seems to be pretty benign. It's equivalent, some studies show, to about 600 milligrams of caffeine, which is about four cups of Starbucks. But you don't get the jitters, and you don't have to go to the bathroom so often.
How interesting. So you see more and more people using those kinds of drugs just to stay alert, stay on top of things.
And keep their jobs. I mean, we know that many people get cosmetic surgery because they think it helps them in the workplace.
Should people be required to disclose the use of these kinds of enhancements?
Well, that would be one possible solution to the unfairness question. Because if not everybody can get their hands on these things, then maybe what we need to know is that, you know, for example, Ted Turner is said to stop taking his lithium, which he takes for bipolar disorder, when he negotiates a big deal, because when he's manic, he feels that he's a better negotiator. And, you know, I don't know if everybody knows that, but maybe he should disclose that at the beginning of negotiations, just like you might disclose that, you know, you have a very high, you know, show that you have a very high-powered lawyer sitting next to you. So that would be one way of doing it. The problem is that you can't enforce that sort of disclosure, because it's very hard. It would be very intrusive. We'd have to live under a regime like the elite athletes live under, where, you know, they can be tested anytime, day or night. They have to let the authorities know where they are all the time. They have to fax in changes of schedule. We wouldn't want to live like that.
Is there, as you write about in your book, a link between the anti-doping war and the war on drugs?
Well, sure, because the first time that athletes were tested for drugs was in 1968, which was when the war on drugs was
Nixon
begun by President
Nixon.
And we also see that among the banned substances, for example, the Olympics bans the use of drugs like marijuana, which have absolutely no known performance-enhancing aspects to them. And you know, a lot of this goes back to the struggle or the disputes in the 60s between athletes and the so-called freaks, or the, you know, the kids who did show up at Woodstock. And I lived through that, and I remember the the very different cultural separation. And so it was the people who thought that drugs were bad generally that were largely in the forefront of the war against doping in sports. The other thing that accounts for it is the Cold War, because the first time that we became aware that athletes were using drugs was when we saw syringes on the floor of a locker room during the 54 Olympics. And we know that the Eastern European athletes used steroids and other kinds of drugs to gain advantages. And so that became a kind of geopolitical battleground. And so that, but the, you know, the problem I have is that, you know, the war on drugs, it's another topic, but you could surely find people who would say it's not been very successful and it's not very well conceived. And the Cold War is over. So the question is, you know, is there a what's the rationale for continuing to prevent people from using these substances?
Have you ever used these substances to enhance your own performance?
I had a cup of coffee before I went on the air with
I
you.
Had two cups.
Nothing beyond that.
Nothing beyond
case.
That.
No.
But suppose my employer came to me and said, Diane, we want you to learn to talk faster because I am a slow speaker. Would I move to one of these drugs to enhance the rapidity of my speech?
Well, you might. I don't know if such a drug exists. But you know, the question would be: what if there's the drug has dangers, bad side effects? Could an employer require you to take those risks? And you know, the law now is not very clear about that. You know, you're supposed to have a safe working environment, but OSHA has not really addressed itself to this possibility.
And what about the FDA and its role in the use of all these various approaches?
Well, for the most part, and until very recently, drugs that are used for enhancement purposes were not reviewed and approved by FDA for those purposes, because they're being used. They were approved for other things. For example, modafinil was originally approved for narcolepsy, to treat narcoleptics, and then people began to use it in what's called off-label use, which means that they were using it for purposes for which the FDA had not, approved it, had not reviewed and approved it. There are now a few products that the FDA has actually approved for enhancement use. Botox is the most well known. A couple of months ago, they approved a drug that increases eyelashes, that gives you longer and fuller eyelashes, and was originally used for a medical purpose, and now it's been approved for that cosmetic purpose.
And, of course, Botox was originally approved for what, blepharospasm?
Right, for essentially facial tics.
And rapid eye movement. And now I have Botox once every 4 months for spasmodic dysphonia, which is off-label.
Right, but which is a medical use, not an enhancement use.
Exactly.
Right? So
to maintain my own voice.
Right. And the question is whether the drug companies will get a sufficient marketing advantage to make it worth spending the enormous amounts of money that it takes to get FDA to approve one of their drugs for enhancement
uses. Is that what it takes, the money?
Last estimate I saw was something like $52 million to get a drug through the research and approval, the average drug through a research and approval process.
So at this point, it's word of mouth when one of these, say somebody says, well, I take so-and-so to help me focus more sharply, and people just begin using it?
Well, word of mouth and word of web, actually. There's a lot of advertising on the web for substances that are claimed to have enhancement effects.
What's your view about all this, Dr. Melman? Do you think that people should be free to use whatever they want with their own bodies, enhancement or not?
Well, I think we have to distinguish between competent adults and people who are not competent, children, people with mental disabilities, and so on. We need to protect the people who need protection. But a competent adult ought to be able to make their own decisions, assuming, first of all, that they have good information. So we do have a role in making, in creating that information. The government should require drug companies to study the enhancement uses of their products, even if they're not approved for that use. We also need to worry about harm to third parties. So if there was an enhancement drug that I took that made me drive very fast, that would be something that we could put our foot down about.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And we're going now to open the phones, 800-433-8850, first to Plymouth, Michigan. Good morning, Julie. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I basically have a comment. I'm a naturopathic medical doctor and an acupuncturist, and it seems to me that the whole kind of topic is coming from this perspective of that the best enhancements are coming from outside things that people do in their everyday life. And what we know is that aging and mental performance and even athletic performance are greatly enhanced by reducing levels of cellular inflammation and paying attention to essential nutrition and levels of essential nutrients like glutathione, as an example. And I'd love to see that information be top tier, and then the information relating to these sort of what I consider more drastic interventions be much more so second tier, so that we get people advice that helps them in more than one way. And
thank you, Julie.
Well, the important thing, though, is that the information that's given to people is accurate and is based on good science. And, one of the problems is that there are parts of this commercial realm, particularly dietary supplements, are not very well regulated, and the information is not very good that people can get about them.
To St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, Tony.
Good day. You might get into implantable controller enhancers, such as the most famous case would be Jerry Lewis, the most famous that I know of, Jerry Lewis, with his nerve controller enhancer implant that he can control his pain by remote control. There are brainwave controller enhancers, implants for presently used for Parkinson's and epilepsy. There are RFID chips, radio frequency chips. There are camera pills used for intestinal cancer supervision, which I would perceive someday to be implantable.
All right, Tony, you've mentioned a number of devices.
Yeah, I don't get into those in my book because I restricted myself to biomedical interventions. I didn't get into the neuromechanical ones that you mentioned, although they're certainly very interesting and we have them around, primarily because that's kind of the province of engineers, and I'm more of a bioethicist, which raises some very interesting issues itself. But increasingly, I'm certainly becoming more aware of the neuroenhancement, for example, deep brain stimulation. There's a technology that you can implant electrodes into the brain of someone with depression and essentially give them a rheostat, an external control, and they can ratchet up the current until they're no longer depressed. And what's interesting is I'm told that the rheostat doesn't stop at, you know, no longer depressed. You can keep going into euphoria, and that's an enhancement use of that. So this
How often has that been used, you know?
It's experimental as far as I know.
I see. Still in mice.
For depression. No, it's in humans.
It's being studied in humans.
Oh, yeah.
So it's reached that level of experimentation.
For that. And it is used for other medical purposes as well.
Now, the other thing that Science Times talked about, and we've seen this in other publications as well, is reduction of food intake by 30% to enhance well-being and to extend life. To what extent would that fall under biomedical enhancement?
Well, again, if you think of aging as a normal process, then reducing your caloric intake drastically, because these are enormous cuts in your daily food intake, would be an enhancement. And it's something that mankind has yearned for ever since the alchemists were looking not only for a way to turn lead into gold, but for the philosopher's stone, which was the elixir of eternal youth. So,
and of course, they're saying that environment can shape a great deal of that longevity as well. We'll take just a short break. Fascinating topic. And we'll welcome your questions and comments.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. By the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And by the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Good morning. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show on WAMU 88.5. I'm Janine Herbst. Coming up on A Prairie Home Companion at 11, Roy Blunt Jr. talks about the art of the Southern Supper. Calvin Trillin remembers a childhood marked by chigger bites. And Iris Dement sings These Hills. Plus, the Carolina Chocolate Drops bring to life the foot-stomping music from the Piedmont region of North Carolina and Virginia. A Prairie Home Companion coming up at 11 on WAMU 88.5.
These days, we're all cutting back on something, rethinking our budgets and taking more public transportation. If you have a vehicle that's costing you more than it's giving you, consider the WAMU 88.5 Vehicle Donation Program. Your contribution in the form of a vehicle helps pay for your favorite shows. To arrange for a pickup, call 866-WAMU-444 or visit WAMU.org for details. Thanks. WAMU 88.5 is currently seeking support from local businesses to help cater our fall membership campaign. By providing an in-kind food donation, your business will help energize our volunteers and strengthen relationships within the community. Plus, your business may be eligible for a tax deduction and will thank you on the air. Contact Anthony Washington at 202-885-1254.
This broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is recorded, so we're not taking any new phone calls.
Welcome back. Maxwell Melman is with me. He is professor of bioethics and law at the Case Western Reserve University. And his new book is titled The Price of Perfection. individualism and society in the era of biomedical enhancement. Here's an email from Jeff, who says, if you take time to observe people when out in public, an overwhelming fact comes to light. More well-off people tend to be more attractive, at least according to society's definition. My hypothesis, he says, is that over the centuries, more affluent men would have a more beautiful wife.
Well, we certainly know that there's a correlation between what you, who you are, or what you look like, and who your mate is, and what he or she looks like. A lot of sociological data to show that correlation. We also know that society rewards people more if the more attractive they are, the taller they are, and not just, you know, the better they are at doing what they do or the smarter that they are. There's a study in Canada that showed that parents were more likely to strap their infants into child restraints when they drove, the more attractive the child was.
Ah, the more attractive the child was, then they're going to take better care of it.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's really kind of shocking to me.
It's extraordinary. Yeah.
When do you think it's appropriate for parents to give biomedical enhancements to children?
Well, it goes back to first how safe they are. If these are dangerous to the child, then a society has reserved properly to itself the right to intervene and accuse the parents of abuse and neglect. But if these are relatively safe, then parents traditionally have been given a great deal of leeway in how to rear their children. The sort of current battleground is over caffeine, I think it's fair to say. We don't interfere with parents giving their kids coffee. And yet there is a controversy over kids being given energy drinks, high caffeine-containing energy drinks. In fact, in some countries, those are banned in large part because of the concerns about use by children. Parents, unfortunately, we see parents who put their kids through the rigors of beauty pageants, who let their kids play sports even after they're injured, conspire with coaches and trainers not to take good care of them because they want their kids to be top athletes and top beauty pageant
players. All right.
So we have to watch that.
Let's go to Baltimore, Maryland. Good morning, Holloway. You're on the air.
Oh, good morning. Thank you both for your wonderful work. My comment speaks to the part that fear plays in all this. I think that there's a fear of growing old in our culture. There's a fear of death, a fear of not looking as good as whatever that might be, whoever's setting the standard. And look at Michael Jackson. He's a tragic example of the Peter Pan complex. And there are other cultures that admire and their elders and that Mexico has the Day of the Dead. They celebrate death. We're scared, and we're being co-opted economically through our fear, I think.
Interesting comment that fear is a driving force.
And indeed the fear of losing our jobs. So we might want to use these technologies to give us a leg up in the workplace. We can use these to make ourselves feel better about ourselves. In other words, for positive, constructive self-satisfaction. But we also see people using these because they're afraid of losing something, whether it's their good looks or whether it's their jobs, whether it's their success in the athletic field.
Here's an email from, Itahi. Who says, I'm sure it was an NPR show about the introduction of caffeine coinciding with the Age of Enlightenment in Europe when people drank coffee instead of alcohol. they thought of all kinds of new ideas. Not much is new. Aren't military pilots required to take enhancement drugs?
Well, the military situation is complicated, and there's a rich history there. For years, particularly pilots, pretty much had to take amphetamines for long-distance combat missions, or they wouldn't be allowed to fly. And, of course, if you're a combat pilot, that's what you live for, is the ability to fly in combat. So they really didn't have much of a choice. And amphetamines, we know, have all kinds of side effects. And in fact, during the beginning of the Afghan War, there was the incident where a number of Canadian soldiers were killed by a friendly fire bombing by U.S. Air Force pilots. And one of the excuses they gave or explanations was that they had taken too much amphetamine to enable them to fly from their bases in Europe to Afghanistan. So the military is now switching to modafinil, which they think has much fewer side effects. But the other thing about caffeine is that we know that it's been used for at least 1,000 years, and certainly, for that time, it's had its enhancement effects. Nicotine also has an enhancement effect, especially if you're a smoker. If you were to stop smoke, you don't want to stop smoking before you take a test. If you're a smoker, and in fact, I have a colleague who says that when he was in law school. For 2 weeks before his final exams, he had stopped smoking before he went to law school, but he would start again for 2 weeks before his final exams and chain smoke the night before his exams.
Why?
He was convinced that it gave him a cognitive advantage the next day.
Do you believe that?
Well, a number of the drugs that are being researched for improving cognitive function in Alzheimer's patients are from the nicotine family, nicotinic derivatives. But clearly, in the case of smoking, the adverse effects, more than outweigh any benefit that you might get.
All right, to Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Hi there, William.
Hi, Diane. Thanks for such a great, thought-provoking show. I have two comments.
Sure.
As a pharmacist, I've seen an alarming increase in these types of drugs being prescribed to children as young as six, not for the actual indication the FDA gave them, which is normally, in the case of Adderall, attention deficit disorder. With Provigil, it's narcolepsy, actually, for performance enhancement. And to say they're not, they're safe in any way, shape, or form is a misnomer. They're controlled substances by the federal government and very addictive, and I've seen the damages they can do. The second comment I wanted to make was that both of those drugs, in the case of Adderall, can cost anywhere from $200 to $300 a month, Provigil, $400 to $600 a month, and that causes a socioeconomic difference in the availability of people who can use them to compete in an academic setting, at least. And it seems to me to be just one more way for a higher-class individual to gain an advantage as someone who doesn't have the economic availability to access that.
I think you've raised an excellent point, William. It would strike me that that's sort of across the board, that money makes a huge difference. Whether it's plastic surgery, whether it's Adderall, Provigil, knee surgery, eye surgery, what have you.
Yeah, there's pretty good data that the rate of prescribing drugs like Ritalin and Adderall is much greater in more affluent communities, suburban communities. And we also know, as you said, that a lot of that prescribing, or at least some of that prescribing, I should say, is not based on or doesn't follow a diagnosis of ADHD or ADD in the kids. It's parents who have figured out that this can give them a greater focus in school, and so they get the doctors to prescribe it without those kinds of diagnoses.
Or is it people striving for, as your book is titled, striving for some measure of perfection that they perceive in their own mind for their children?
Yeah, we know that parents often live through their children, live their lives through their children. But I think it's more that the parents will do anything they can to give their children an advantage in life. And one of my favorite stories is of the parents who fed their toddler okra three times a day before they applied her to a very exclusive Manhattan preschool on the theory that one of the questions that the kid would be asked in the interview
is, what do you eat?
What do you like to eat? And the kid who said okra would have an advantage over a kid who said ice cream or peanut butter and jelly. The other thing we have to worry about in terms of school-age kids being given these things is that schools can be pressuring the parents to give their kids these drugs, for example, so that the school can do better on standardized testing, or so that the kid is a better student and you know, helps others.
William, as a pharmacist, do you ever question people who come in with those kinds of prescriptions as to, you know, raise any questions with them?
It's difficult to question a doctor's diagnosis. It's even more difficult to question a parent's motive. We do counsel about what the drug is intended for. And in the case of Provigil, a lot of times when you tell them the FDA has only approved it for narcolepsy, their first question is, what is narcolepsy? And then once you explain what it is, they find it odd that they've been prescribed that without that diagnosis. It doesn't necessarily change the outcome of them receiving the medication.
Interesting.
What often does is the price of the medication.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for calling, William. Let's go now to Charlottesville, Virginia. Hi there, Doug. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, great show. I think we need to recall ourselves the United States of narcissism, and I'm not making a moral judgment. When I was in my 20s and 30s and a stage performer, I took minoxidil to help keep my hair on my head, and I, at the end of my career, I had stage fright, and people said I should take beta blockers, and if I wasn't so old, I would have done it. I understand why people do these things, but I've given up my own narcissism, but now I do have children. I have a beautiful daughter, and I just got her braces. But I actually feel guilty about it, as someone pointed out earlier. I feel like it is superficial, but am I supposed to tell my daughter that she can't have it when all her friends do? It's just such a complex question, and it just seems to me that no one else seems to feel guilty about these things when they do it.
Doug, can I ask you a question?
Yes, you may.
Are her teeth in need of straightening?
Well, as you said earlier, the dentist said yes. In fact, one of her teeth will not come in if we do not move the two teeth on the other side
out
of the way.
Yeah.
So he did put it in sort of orthodontic terms.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if he did that to make the decision easier for me. But I will say I have a younger son, and it's already going through my mind that since he's a boy, maybe he won't need braces. But how crazy is that? But I understand how people end up making crazy decisions if they have enough money to do it.
That's a key question. At 6 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Doug does seem to have the money to provide the braces for his child, but he's feeling guilty.
Yeah, and we have to remember all of the people who don't have the money to do that, and yet they're competing with the children whose parents do in a very unfair playing field. By the way, you mentioned beta blockers, and that's another very interesting biomedical enhancement issue, because pentathlon athletes who have to at cross-country ski very energetically and then suddenly stop and shoot at a target, and they have to be absolutely still when they shoot at the target. And so some of them have been caught taking beta blockers like propranolol because it slows their heartbeat and allows them to be still when they shoot. It's become an issue for musicians, not only for stage fright, but particularly for string musicians, because it steadies the hands so the bows don't skitter across the strings. But if you say, well, they shouldn't be able to use it, what about surgeons who take it to steady their hands? The line between acceptable and objectionable uses of these drugs is a very difficult one to draw. And yet I know of some people who've been lost their jobs teaching music because they've suggested that their students might consider taking these things before competitions.
Thanks for calling, Doug. Good luck to you. And finally to Kimberly, who's in San Antonio, Texas. You're on the air.
Yes, I was just going to comment on some other callers' comments. The one most about the a lot of successful people being more attractive, and couldn't it be somewhat viewed from the other end that when people find something at which they're successful, then they're pressured to enhance their appearance or performance. An example would be Susan Boyle. I mean, she was very successful. Her appearance had nothing to do with her beautiful voice, and yet automatically when it was discovered that she was a beautiful singer, you need to change your appearance.
Good point.
Yeah, and we unfortunately we've had some examples of actors who've undergone cosmetic surgery, and it's really wrecked their careers because they no longer have that distinctive look. I mean, if Barbara Streisand had fixed her nose, I mean, what a tragedy that
would
have been for
her career. To say, "I'm not doing this." That's all there is to it. My nose is my nose, but. You know, I think it's hard to resist that kind of pressure.
Absolutely. Especially when it's, you know, and it's insidious. It can be imposed on you from outside, by schools, by work, by
so
employers.
So what is the message you want to send to people?
Well, most importantly, if you're thinking of using these things, make sure you know what the risks are. Second, don't give them to kids unless you're absolutely sure that they're safe, and do so only under a doctor's supervision. On the other hand, I think that we need to separate the war on drugs from the war on enhancements.
Maxwell Melman, and his new book is titled The Price of Perfection, Individualism and Society in the Era of Biomedical Enhancement. Thanks for being here.
You're welcome.
And I appreciate your listening. Talk to you tomorrow. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe and podcasts.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. From the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. And from the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Good morning.